This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Is the end of one war merely the overture to the next? In the thriller Dying Days, Anthony Burt explores this notion when the disappearance of both civilians and occupying troops in Trieste at the end of World War I is investigated. So, Anthony, welcome to 3CR.
Oh, thanks so much, David. It's great to be here.
Now, let's set the scene here. Trieste, Italy. Why is this such a pivotal point in the immediate aftermath of Germany's surrender?
So I'm just going to pull you up on one thing. You said World War One and the...
World War II.
World War II. So we'll just get that clear for the...
World War II, Trieste. I beg your pardon.
So to your question, Trieste is a fascinating place in May 1945, primarily because, as all of us will know, the war in Europe is winding up at that stage. The Russians have reached Berlin, and the Italian peninsula has largely been liberated. Now, Trieste was one of the last parts of Italy to be liberated, and what happened at the very start of May is that Tito's Yugoslav partisans had been pushing up what is essentially the Croatian coast now towards Trieste, and the New Zealanders, as the advance troops for the British, had been coming up the Italian coast. And Churchill basically said to the New Zealanders, get to Trieste as quickly as you can because we need to secure it before Tito does, because it was such an important port city at the top of the Adriatic there.
Because what did Churchill fear?
Well, Churchill feared that Tito and essentially the communist bloc would get control of this very, very important port. And although they were ostensibly allies, he wanted to make sure that the Western allies had that access before he did.
Well, that was the pending conflict that could have occurred, which resulted in the Cold War. But you've also got other factions. You've got fascists, you've got nationalists, partisans. So the allies, they're all, there's an interplay between them all there, all with their own agenda of what the future should be.
Yeah, very much so. And that's because Trieste is this pressure point between, I guess, the sort of Slavic states. So it's right on the border of Slovenia as well, but also this Italian nationalist kind of movement. It's always been a sort of emblem, particularly for Mussolini's regime, of how Italy should expand east.
And where should one allegiances lie? But now we get into a bit of a thriller. Two local girls disappear, Lara and Eleanor Bury. This is problematic for a number of reasons. Why?
Well, it's problematic because so the New Zealanders arrived within about 6 or 7 hours of the Yugoslavs, and there followed a sort of standoff in the city, a sort of peaceful standoff, but nonetheless a very tense one. And the New Zealanders very quickly started to sort of side with the local Italian population rather than the Yugoslav or Slovenian side of things. And so there was actually an officer's ball that was held in Trieste, which I used as the backdrop for this event. But essentially what these events and the behaviours of the New Zealanders did was sort of ratchet up the tension for the Yugoslavs because they were not very impressed by the New Zealanders' behaviour in the cities.
And also then, with the disappearance of girls, this is a bit of a narrative deception on your behalf.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it sort of unfolds, I guess, for the first part of the book in that we get the sense that these two beautiful young women have disappeared after this ball where they were there with New Zealand officers. But then obviously the plot takes a bit of a twist about a third of the way in and we realise that actually we're on a very different kind of investigation.
Well, Lara and Eleanor Bury, but what have the Bury family been doing?
So they, so the girls are from a very wealthy Italian family and who've been in Trieste for a long time. And they were really, I guess, hosts to their previous kind of Nazi occupation in some ways.
Collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's that sort of ambiguous thing that was obviously happening a lot in cities that were occupied by the Germans. And the interesting thing about Trieste in particular is that when the Italians capitulated in September 43, Hitler and Himmler actually sent the same team who had been running the first death camps in Poland down to run Trieste. So they had this very, very heavy, very bad news crew of SS blokes who'd been doing some absolutely, you know, heinous things in Poland before that.
Anyway, we get Alexandro, or Alex Madigan, and Mark Donnelly to come in. Madigan, S-I-S-S-O-E. The difference between these two groups, one is sneaking around in the dark or sneaking around in the dark so you can blow shit up. That's Madigan. He's a bit of a spy. Donnelly is a representative of the New Zealand forces. So what are they... I mean, they are brought together to explore the disappearance of these two girls. But there's another problem here because four New Zealand servicemen have also disappeared. So what are the possibilities here that we could be facing here?
Well, the possibilities with the disappearance of these four New Zealanders who've ostensibly taken off with these girls, but obviously things take a twist at some stage, is sort of myriad, really. But the main possibility is that it ignites a conflict between the Yugoslav partisans and the New Zealanders inside Trieste, which is, of course, what everybody at a political level is trying to desperately avoid so that another war doesn't begin on a new front. And so a lot of things suggest that these New Zealanders have been disappeared by the Yugoslavs because the Yugoslavs are in the process of arresting and disappearing a lot of Italians who they believe to have been collaborators with the Nazi regime.
Now, they could also be taking advantage of the girls, except all of a sudden you do something. You bring... Can we reveal what happens to the girls?
Yeah, I think we have to.
We have to.
Because it's so essential to the rest of the book.
Well, the girls turn up.
Yeah.
But that then could possibly implicate them in the disappearance of the four New Zealand servicemen. So here we have then Madigan and Donnelly trying to work out who's doing what. But now Madigan and Donnelly don't get on. Madigan's very, how shall we say it, direct with interviewing Lara and also with a priest. What does he do?
Well, he's not beyond using violence to get the answers that he's seeking out of these people as a kind of interrogation technique. And I think the important backstory to Madigan is that we learn that he's been in and around Trieste working with various partisan groups for a couple of years. And that's very much based on what was happening in particularly northeast Italy and Slovenia and from sort of 43 on. But he's morally ambiguous. You know, he needs to get to the answer quickly, and he will use whatever means he needs to get to that. And that obviously causes tension with Donnelly.
And Donnelly can't face it, wants to quit. But here we go, because Madigan has the support of the hierarchy. What you saw and what Alex believed he was doing are not necessarily the same thing. That's Donnelly's commander. So what's happening here to morality?
I think what's happening to morality in that context is that there are people who understand that performance is part of getting to where they need to be. And Madigan is certainly somebody who has had to use performance, use identity shifting, use all manner of techniques to find the truth of what he's going after.
Well, identity shifting, this leads to the next quote, because the situation in the region is far more problematic, and this quote sums it up. To survive here, you have to accept that everything is fiction. Names change, nationalities shift, power swaps hands, everyone lies. The local people believe in fairy tales and monsters in the woods. This is what Alex understands. It's why he's still alive. So all of a sudden, we've lost morality completely, if that's the nature of the environment we're in.
I think we've lost a sort of black and white morality for sure. I think that everybody in the story has their version of a truth, and they have their version of a deception that they need to use to get that truth kind of manifest, if that makes sense. So you have this kind of performative spectrum somehow of people who are spread from people with extreme fascist ideologies to these British and New Zealand officers who are just trying to figure out what's going on, but are fairly elastic in their own morality to get to that. Yeah.
Just as the disappearance of the girls at the beginning of the novel was a deception, the assumption that we will find an individual responsible is also a conventional premise that is challenged. We do actually find out what happened to the missing New Zealand servicemen, but the answer actually lies in the machinations of regimes and political power. Signora Angela Burry accuses Madigan of being part of the problem. How many people have you killed in this war, Major? If you won't answer, I'll do it for you. Thousands, Alex. You and your British monsters. Thousands. By backing Marshal Tito and his filthy Slav followers, you've sent thousands of Italians to their death. So now political regimes are the ones that are the culprits, rather than an individual.
Yeah, I think that's very much part of where I was going. And also, I mean, the thing about Angela Bury is that she is obviously complicit with this kind of collaborationist Italian regime. So when she's talking about filthy Slavs, she's obviously, you know, coming from a very extreme opposite position. Whereas Madigan has been obviously very much aligned with those Yugoslav partisans for the last couple of years in terms of supporting them to get to.
So it could be things are justified because of the political party or the country you follow, but then you take it another step beyond that. The only force that will change the world is beautiful chaos. Anarchy? No, even that is too prescriptive. We need a new chaos of terror and love. Only this, when everything has been set, only then, when everything has been set back to the beginning, should ideas begin to congeal into doctrine. And again, this is Angela Bury, but she's actually basically spruiking the ideas of Gabriele D'Annunzio, who was a poet. So in this thriller, it's not an individual, it's not a political party. Poetry is the culprit. Can you explain yourself, sir?
Well, poetry is one of the culprits, but I think that, I mean, I was very fascinated by Gabriele D'Annunzio's influence in early 20th century Italian culture in particular, and, you know, particularly his influence on Mussolini, who came later on. And he really was this very out there, erotic, amazing kind of sensual writer of novels and poetry, but he also became this fierce Italian nationalist in World War One, and then really laid some of the foundations for the ideas that Mussolini developed into a more violent kind of form of fascism.
And it's this inspiration, this creating of an ideal within a culture, within a community, which then compels people to go to war, perhaps, which then leads to the loss of life that follows, the thousands that die. So can we blame poetry in the end of it all?
Well, I don't think we blame poetry exclusively, but I was interested in looking at the way that art, more generally say, not just poetry, in the earlier 20th century played a part in the development of these ideologies. I mean, that
but it still happens today.
Absolutely.
And so it can account for why atrocities were committed if we lose sight of morality and that progression that takes place.
Yeah.
So we've had a very quick run through the novel. It's actually a thriller. People go missing. It's investigated, but it's set against this backdrop of the end of World War II. Let's get it right. But also these ideologies that take place. But is it an overture to the new days that lie ahead? The end of one conflict could simply lead to another. But then the sleight of hand that you've used, because you've challenged convention with these disappearances, which makes us in some ways all complicit in murder and mayhem. So if you want to find out what happened to the New Zealand soldiers that disappeared, and there was a rumour, an actual rumour that happened, you are going to have to read Dying Days by Anthony Burt, and it's from Affirm Press. So Anthony, thank you for talking with me today.
Well, thank you so much, David. It's been an absolute pleasure.
We've got a little segue here. We've got missing girls, we've got morality and poetry. I can't believe it. But we do have Melbourne as well. I've chatted with Rebecca Lim a number of times, and it has been about young adult novels, but this new book is certainly written for adults. Her quote, "All filters are off, and the horror can be in the foreground." Welcome back, Rebecca.
Thanks so much, Jan.
Your other books usually feature a young teenage girl, and this one does too. In fact, three of them. But what makes this book so adult, so different, so difficult.
It was a hard sell to say that it was a satire as well as a novel that's centred on a paedophile. So a bit of a difficult thing to actually pitch to people, but it's got a few sort of fairly dark themes in it, like, you know, colonialism, murder, mayhem, 1970s career criminals.
And an ESP, an Eastern Suburb paedophile. Three girls from the same school in three successive years, then nothing. And you've based this on a little bit of truth in your own background.
I don't talk about this often, but I guess the nucleus for this story was the still unsolved Mr. Cruel crimes that happened in Melbourne. So what I've tried to do is, you know, make it into a thought experiment where one of the victims actually came back and maybe tried to figure out who had done this to the girls that disappeared.
So the girls were 13. Then they just disappeared themselves until two of them reconnected. And I'd like Rebecca Lim to read from The Graduate.
So this is an extract from the start of the book. Since Faye and Hayley had reconnected online, Faye had learned all about Hayley's stints in expensive private clinics since she'd left school, the 60 precise hours she'd been held captive, the bleach baths, the deafening talkback radio, the apricot bedspread, the white chipboard bedside table with a lamp on it with a coordinated apricot-coloured shade. The video camera on a tripod at the base of the double bed, like a low-rent pornographer's motel room in Hades. Glimpses from over or under a blindfold hastily moved, then moved back, of a brown cardboard box with the word Paukiaho stenciled across one side in capital letters in permanent marker, jammed into a bookcase across the room. The plain apricot bedspread covering the bookcase had slipped just once, Hayley said. And that one word was the only link she had to those hours, that room, that house. She'd obsessed over that word ever since. It's the loose thread, that word, Hayley told Faye. You just need one and it will all lead back to him.
Lead back to him. And what they wanted to do, and this is another quote, revenge. Badly, badly hurt the guy with the sharpest instrument at her disposal. Bathe him like a baby in pure bleach. Shoot him in the face for good measure. Well, this takes a lot of work on Evelyn's part. So she does get back to Melbourne 30 years later, and her graduate application does have some peculiarities because she studied law over this time. And her specific area is Roman law, because this word,
Paukiaho,
what does it mean?
It's actually a Samoan word, I think, or a Polynesian word, and it means exhausted. In this novel, I mean, I think I've probably tried to jam-pack it with too many things, but I kind of also deal with Australia's dark experiments in empire and the Pacific island nations around us. So there's a few threads going on in here. Hopefully it doesn't lose anybody, but it's a satirical look at the Australian legal industry, because I'm still part of that, and also just the fact that, you know, paedophiles in Melbourne especially seem to be able to get away with murder, like literal murder.
Absolutely. Now, one of the reasons she's picked up by this very good law firm is because she has got a very good academic background, but she also puts in a poem. You know, the Roman law was interesting enough, but the poem was really a bit of a surprise. She's also has to look like a graduate. She has to look 20 years younger. And so how does she achieve this?
Has anyone ever heard of the term Asian don't raisin? It's kind of a Gen Z thing. So I've kind of taken that notion of, you know, some Asian people looking super, super young and just run with that. So that's kind of at the core of this, is a bit of a deception.
But her makeup, another quote, eyelashes so thickly caked with mascara, sections of them were clumped together in chunks. The apples of her cheeks were highlighted so heavily in a bright coral pink powder that it appeared as if she was actually blushing furiously at all times. Her makeup bill was astronomical. All the money she spent on primer, BB cream, concealer, mascara, bronzer, hair dye, foundation, for the mere possibility of finding him. As you say, she looked like a cartoon Asian woman, right down to the slightly curved wooden chopstick thing jammed into her ponytail. War paint as armour.
I think a lot of women do that, especially in the workplace. I mean, a lot of, I think, younger women, when they sort of hit a hyper-masculine workplace, have to, you know, develop some kind of armour like that. And for this character, extreme makeup was the way to go, I think.
At the law firm EM&L, she is openly called the diversity unicorn. Why was that?
I mean, I'm making a bit of a play on this. Like, often I'm on diversity panels where I'm the only diversity. So I think sometimes you take someone who looks, you know, unpromising, who looks extremely sort of like agency-less, out of control, and you use that as something that they can, you know, use as a shield to get what they want. So she looks like an unpromising graduate, the least promising graduate in this law firm, but it actually enables her to basically hide in plain sight.
There's a senior partner, Matt St. John, and he's talking about the graduate. We're not equipped to babysit people of her dubious cultural background. They aren't like us. They're like weevils in the flower, the Chinese. One day they will rise up and spoil everything. Oh,
I had so much fun writing this. It was hilarious because I remember when I was a kid, like in the 80s, there was this book that my parents had in the house. Like, we had terrible books in the house, like, you know, Peter Bentley's Jaws, like really terrible books. And there was a book on the shelf that was called Weevils in the Flower, and it just stuck with me forever. So I just thought I'd repurpose that for this novel.
Well, Evelyn, who's now called Feifei, is surprised when the CEO, Tony Lincoln, takes a personal interest in her, inviting her out for long lunches. What's his reputation with women on the workforce?
Another thing I was making satire of, I mean, this happens in lots of workplaces where there's, you know, really powerful men and really junior women, but his reputation is one of, you know, taking the clerk who's sitting in his office at the time or the graduate and just, you know, having clandestine or very sort of very public affairs with them. So that's his kind of reputation in the marketplace.
And, of course, all the other work people look at him and see what he's doing and say, no, oh, he likes them child size. So you wonder about that. And then the other graduates, they don't have much confidence in her making it through the year.
She just doesn't look like them. So I just wanted to take someone who sort of didn't look like anyone else and looked very unpromising and just sort of make her the deus ex machina in this story.
There's one graduate who's now, you know, 20 years later, Nina Dutchens. Well, let's hear about her.
Nina was dressed all in tangerine today, like an attention-seeking, dick-seeking beacon. She looked like a woman-shaped lollipop or an upmarket brothel madam, if Faye were to be honest, in her curvy citrus skirt suit and plunging white V-neck T-shirt, topped by newly bleached hair in a tight updo and those ridiculous Clark Kent glasses, worn purely to indicate she was a bombshell with brains, the whole damn package. She appeared to have had a head-to-toe spray tan since Faye had last seen her, made more orange by the outfit she was wearing and her intensely blonde hair. Nina's leopard print heels appeared at least 8 inches high, dramatically lengthening her faintly orange legs.
So it's obvious Feifei has absolute distaste for this faker and show pony, but it's the poem that's on Feifei's accreditations to get into the graduate, to become the graduate, that raises the ire of Nina, who is super competitive. Nina was beaten for the English prize back at school by a very similar poem. And so she is wondering, could it be Evelyn? In contrast to the hard-working lawyers, there's Julian. How did he get a job there?
He's a Nepo baby, so I've just made sure I inserted one of those into the narrative as well. So he's the nephew of Tony Lincoln, the man who has affairs.
And as Tony says, no charm and no prospects. But he's working in an area of importance to Feifei.
I've taken really dry things like company searches and national police checks, and I've made that into a novel. So hopefully, you know, that's interesting to everyone. But I've taken lots of really basic, you know, units in a law firm, and I've given them sort of a bit of, like, you know, red herring status or clue status.
Oh. So he's coerced into helping to find this Pakeho to be a large pastoral property, location unknown, legally registered nowhere, a missing sale agreement, and a buyer who was once a client of EM&L, but no details of the seller. And more investigation show how the sole owner, Gertrude Evett Hills, pays for this immense property.
I've tried to also sort of satirise things like people with enormous wealth, and I'm not mentioning a billionaire who, you know, has cattle stations up in the north, but that kind of strata of Australian society also gets a run in this novel. So there's a lot going on. I'm not sure if it sounds fascinating to anybody, but it was a lot of fun to write.
It was great. So we've talked about plot A, being tracking down the paedophile. Plot B is the sovereign national ex. So just explain.
That's basically an exploration of, you know, our experiments in empire in places like Nauru and Christmas Island. And, you know, the fact that, you know, the weevils and the flower, the sort of dead Chinaman on which, you know, Australian prosperity was built. So, again, another subplot that doesn't sound very fascinating, but it just gave me a chance to look at, you know, the myths, like in Anthony's book, the myths that we sell ourselves about what this nation is and what it was built on.
There's also a lurking brown man. We know he worked for the rapist. This is something he said to the rapist. You killed her. You're not supposed to kill them. You fiddle with them and then you put them back. It's not brain surgery. You get your jollies, you move on. But it's his presence all the time through the book. And you've given him, this is more of your legal background, a whole page of his crimes, A to Z.
Of all of, yeah, things like assault with weapons, aggravated assault, all that kind of stuff. So I had a lot of fun with that. That was my childhood in the 70s, watching shows like Homicide and Cop Shop. So that's all come out into the novel as well.
It was an absolutely fascinating read. So what do Thank you think you. You're going to do now? Are you going to stick with adult crime or go back to that suspensefully type of young stuff?
I might actually do some sci-fi next. We'll see. Oh, I've got to keep it interesting. You know, if it's interesting for me, it's interesting for, you know, other readers, hopefully. So, yeah, that might be my next gig.
Can a top-tier law firm be made accountable for silencing the protests from environmental damage in another country or hiding pedophile killer? The Graduate is on a quest for justice in this crime novel by Rebecca Lim. She did him in, and I'm so pleased.
Thank you, Jan. Thanks so much.
I might have given away the end of the story, but boy, oh boy, the reading through it was fascinating.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.